story not long ago. High on a mountain in Idaho, in Idaho, I was living free. Sold a sawed-off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down. Down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. Down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. And you wanna go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
On Ruby Ridge, please, please don't shoot me down. Down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
Good evening. This is Truth Quest with Melody and Eric. And tonight, well, this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, and thanks a lot, Brad, with great chicken salad. And tonight we've got Vicki Davis, and she is a systems analyst that her job got outsourced, and so she became a researcher for the last 5 years off of the internet. And in that time frame, she has picked up a lot of interesting information, and her and I kind of connected, and I thought she would be kind of an interesting person to interview tonight. And at the same time, I had a couple of PSAs to go through, and so just a second. Well, we'll just go on and get Vicki on here. Eric, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
No, it doesn't sound like. See, this is where I'm wondering.
Hello.
There you go. There you go. And Vicki, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Great. I guess we can go ahead and start out and see a little bit is how you got into spending this kind of time doing your research, and how it has led into seeing what's going on in the world out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really wasn't my job that got outsourced. It was my career. You know, when they started out, I was a contractor.
Okay.
And so as a contractor, you know, you work for a while at one company, do a project, and then move to another company. So once they started outsourcing, you know, it kind of torpedoed my career. So that's how I got happened to have end up having the time. And I really got on the internet when the FCC was just about to make a decision to allow further consolidation of the media. And I thought that was really just a horrible idea, you know. And I had done research on the internet prior to that, but really it was just, you know, looking up things for myself. I really wasn't involved in any email groups or any activism or anything like that. But once I got started, you know, with that FCC decision, and I found out about outsourcing, you know, that they were sending our knowledge jobs over to India, then I really got serious about researching because of the national security implications of doing that. Our country is almost totally dependent on the computer systems that make it run. You know, and I, the example I always use is a grocery store. You know, they use supply chain management systems such that they don't have to store things in a warehouse for very long. And so, you know, if they stop delivery to a grocery store, just all of a sudden, it wouldn't be a week before the shelves would be empty, you know, even at a big Walmart. And so that really, really concerned me that they were sending our computer systems that make our country run over to a foreign country, because that's kind of like giving your pacemaker to somebody else, the control for your pacemaker to somebody else to hold. You know, they're holding your life in their hands, and it's a really bad, bad idea.
Vicki, before we – can you hear me, Vicki?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Eric Carlstrom. Before we get into some of the things that you've discovered, you're in Idaho now. Your career, is this where you were brought up? Is this where you had your career?
No, I actually – well, I was brought up here, but I worked all over the country, you know, California, Washington, Alaska, New York, Arizona. I, you know, was kind of a gypsy contractor, you might say.
And you have a website that you maintain now. Could you tell us what that is?
Mm-hmm. It's www.channelingreality.com.
And for those who would be curious to go on to the website and learn what you've been discovering, could you give us some of just the main topics that you would cover on that website?
I tried to organize it in according to the research that I've done. And so I have it broken out into the silent war, which is really kind of the war that's going on the American people right now. The official name for it is called low-intensity conflict. And basically it's a war in the context of everything else. That means that they don't shoot bullets at you, but every other thing that they can do, they're doing to us.
Like an info war?
Info war, psychological warfare, economic warfare, cultural warfare. It truly is war in the context of everything else. And so I wrote about each one of those areas, you know, just to give an overview. The next section is new federalism. Now, under the Clinton administration, they basically reinvented our government, and those are their words, not mine. And what the reinvention of government was is a new federalism. And basically the way it works is that the federal government comes up with framework legislation, but the implementation of it and funding for it is done by NGOs. And my theory on that, the reason why they did that is because what they wanted to do would violate not only the law, but the Constitution and everything else. So they pushed it off onto NGOs to do in kind of a sub rosa way.
And, of course, NGO being non-governmental organizations. Could you give us an example of that?
Yeah, the Smart Growth Network. The Smart Growth Network is all over the place, but if you trace it back, what you find out is that it was actually initially funded and organized by the EPA. And they get grants not only from the federal government, but also from private entities. And so they're mixing the agenda of these private entities with government, the government framework, and they're implementing Agenda 21 through these NGOs.
And using those NGOs, that they do that primarily because they can kind of fly under the radar of some of the regulations. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they can circumvent the Democratic.
That's what my thinking is.
Yeah. And they can also circumvent the democratic process. Isn't that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, very interesting. We want to come back to Agenda 21. And then what else is on your website, Vicki?
Okay, after the section on new federalism, I have a section that's called coup d'etat. And what I consider happened during the 1990s was that they executed an administrative coup d'etat on our government, because basically what they did is dismantle it, and they contracted out all of the government administrative functions to private corporations.
Who's they?
And when you do that, what you're doing is you're turning the power of government over to the private corporations, because without, you know, all power derives from a base. And if government, if, you know, when you think about the presidency and the Congress, their power to do anything derives from their ability to enact it, right? So what they did by contracting out the administrative functions of government was to transfer that power to the those private corporations. And if you watch the congressional hearings very much, what you'll see is that now the Congress asks for reports from the administrative departments of government, and basically the administrative departments of government just blow them off. They don't even produce reports that are mandated by law anymore. So the Congress really doesn't have much power in terms of the execution of laws that they pass in the administrative departments of government.
And that was by design.
That was by design. And if you there's a report called Catastrophic Terrorism: Elements of a National Policy. And that report was done in the 1990s as part of a project called the Preventative Defense Project that was headed up by William Perry, and he was Defense Secretary under Clinton, and Ashton Carter. And part of the Preventative Defense Project included doing this report that was called Catastrophic Terrorism: Elements of a National Policy. And part of that report defined the new federalism, the new government structure, as market-based governance. Okay.
So they're tying catastrophe in with market?
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Ah.
That the two parts of the report had to do with catastrophic terrorism as elements of a national policy, and market-based governance.
Can we assume that it would be the catastrophic terrorism events, perhaps cooked up, perhaps synthetic, which throw the country into the market-based government?
That's what I think. That's okay. My opinion.
In other words, that this is a deliberate plan that was laid out ahead of time, perhaps back in the 90s, in order to move the country in this desired direction, basically to privatize all the functions of government.
That's what I think.
Turn it into a corporation, basically.
Mm-hmm. According to my analysis. Now, here's the interesting thing. Philip Zelikow, who was the administrative director of the 911 Commission, basically the gatekeeper, he also participated in the preparation of that report.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And so 9/11 being kind of their catastrophe to kind of initiate this, in a sense?
Well, that's my analysis, yes. But But, you know, people might argue with me, and anybody is welcome to challenge me on it. You know, if it isn't that, then tell me what it is, because everything that I see points to that.
Anecdotally, I've read a lot about the 911 commission as well as the whole 911 issue, and as far as I can recall, Philip Zelikow, who was the man, as you say, who was in charge of putting together the 911 commission report, had also co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. Was this the book that you're talking about?
No, I think the book that he authored with Condoleezza Rice had to do with Russia, but I'm not sure.
Oh, okay, okay.
They worked together quite a
yes.
bit.
Yes, yeah, they're definitely a team, yeah. Okay, great. So we've got the Silent War as part one, the New Federalism as part two, the coup d'etat as part three, and we can assume that this is not just 911, but that it's an agenda that actually preceded 911 in the 90s. Is that correct?
That's what it looks like to me.
Okay, and then is there another part after that?
Yeah, the shock and awe.
Okay.
And that part is about 911. Okay, but that was my early research before I saw the connections to the North American Union.
And so you're saying 9/11 is connected to the North American Union, which is connected to Agenda 21?
I believe it is, yes.
Okay.
Well, is that the basis of your site, the four parts, or is there another?
I also have a section on education, the education system, because the transformation that's going on in our country, the education system is integral to that. And as a matter of fact, if you go back and you look, you follow what they did in the 90s in the education system, you can see there's evidence that they were preparing the education system for what they were about to do to our economy.
When you say they, can you be a little more specific?
Yeah. In 1991-1992, George Bush established a commission called the New American Schools. Let me find it here so I can give it to you accurately.
I know it.
New American Schools for the New World Order.
Oh, boy.
And basically what he did is that he convened a committee of corporations to redesign the American school system.
This is a report, a federal report or a presidential report, the New American Schools for the New World Order?
I do have a document that I got off of the government website, the education website, and it's a paper that was written by a man named Douglas Noble, N-O-B-L-E. And the title of his paper is called New American Schools and the New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the education department at the time, and he is the one that documented this. But if you want to do a search on it, you can search on the New American Schools Development Corporation, the NASDC. And that was established in 1991 by President George Bush, the first Bush, and the goal of that commission was to redesign the American schools. Now, the corporations, the members that belong to it, let's see, there's James Jones, CEO of the American Stock Exchange, James Baker, John Clendenin of Bell South, Linda Wachner, Louis Gerstner of RJR. Gerstner was also the CEO of IBM, and now he's the CEO of the Carlyle Group, by the way.
Boy, these guys play musical chairs with those corporations.
Yeah, they sure do. But this is a very, very interesting paper. And I know Microsoft was involved in it also.
Okay, excellent. So basically the five different parts of your website are devoted to those topics. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And it sounds to me like you've done an awful lot of research. What would you say would be your main sources? Would it be internet sources? Would it be books? Would it be videos, movies? Would it be a combination of the above?
Mostly everything that's on the internet that's available.
Okay.
And for my sources, I try mostly to pick up from government and credible mainstream sources. I do read the you know, what people would call the conspiracy websites, but I read those for search terms to look for myself. You know, I verify what I find on them.
So you're looking
And I would hope that everybody else does that too.
Okay. Have you built up a pretty good library of materials at home, I imagine, with files and files and files?
Oh, yeah.
On these topics?
Yes.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I had to buy a new hard drive just recently.
Would you consider that, I'm sorry, Vicki, I'm curious about this. I'm not really trying to pin you down, but I'm just curious. Are you involved with a group of researchers, or are you entirely independent?
Well, I'm loosely involved with a few other independent researchers. We're all independent, but what tends to happen when you research things on the internet is that if you write something good, then, you know, people will contact you about it. And so, you know, there are a group of, I'd say maybe three or four really serious researchers that I communicate with on different subjects.
And do they publish quite a bit themselves?
A couple of them do. One of them who was a really outstanding researcher that got started in the education area, she's published a few things, but for the most part she just kind of stays back in email groups and sends out information through her loops, as she calls them.
So she doesn't really want to get out there mainstream?
Right. Okay. Yeah, she's kind of a shy person. Actually, believe it or not, I really am too. I never really wanted, you know, my name out there either, but it just kind of happened, you know.
Well, we sure appreciate all the work that you're doing, and I might just mention that I think you speak very lucidly, so we appreciate that, too. Could we just go through some of these topics here? Now, your first one was Silent War, and I've been teaching a course called Human Ecology for a number of years at Cal State University, Stanislaus, and I, in this course on environmental issues, I've come more and more to look at economic issues and integrate those with the environmental problems that we have, and also to look at things like terrorism worldwide. And this term you threw out, low-intensity conflict, indeed is a synonym for terrorism and has been what our armed forces have trained in for decades now, and certainly what we saw in the Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, all over Latin America, as well as other parts of the world where our CIA and other armed forces were involved, were examples of this kind of low-intensity conflict, which essentially is war against the civilian population. Now what you're saying is that perhaps they've taken what they've learned through all this practice, many decades of subjugating the third world to these kinds of techniques, and now they're turning them on the American people. Would that be fair to say?
That's the way I see it. Yes.
Could you elaborate a little bit about that? What low intensity conflict is, and what some examples would be?
Well, for example, the groups that these special interest groups that PETA, for example, I consider PETA to be an insurgent group that has an agenda to get people to actually cut down on their meat intake. Now, if you look at what they're doing to our economy, they are really crushing the middle class.
Okay, could you define PETA? I don't even know what it is.
Oh, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Oh, okay. Okay, could you go ahead and explain why this is now an insurgent group?
Well, I consider them to be an insurgent group because basically what they want to get people to do is to stop eating meat. You know, they really don't want you to eat that hamburger or that steak or whatever it is. And I see it as all part of the agenda of changing the lifestyle of the American people because basically, they're crushing the middle class.
Wouldn't it also
economically, socially, and culturally?
Wouldn't that also tie into the fact that if they're going to be wilding America and wanting to get the farmer and rancher out of these rural areas, that they would use various means to get the demand for meat out of the marketplace, and that would be one way of doing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is an interesting example. Okay, PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, would come across, I suppose, at the surface as a group of altruistic, idealistic, ethical people. But you're saying that this group might have been kind of co-opted by others, for example, who have an entirely different agenda.
Yeah. Yes. In all of these groups, these NGO groups, you have the people that are true believers, you know, the especially in the environmental movement, well, and with animals too, actually. You have the people that are truly sincere about what they're doing, and then you have the insurgents that have a different agenda.
There's a book called, Cloak of Green, I guess by Elaine Duar, came out in the 90s, talking about how the environmental movement has been co-opted or maybe was partly formed itself by kind of the corporate robber barons who intended to use the environmental movement to take over the world.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
Well, only what Melody was telling me about it, and it sounds like a book that I'm going to need to read. Because if you go back and you start looking at the environmental movement and the people involved in it and everything else, there is an agenda there that has nothing to do with the environment. It has to do with wanting people to change the way that they're living. Only mm-hmm. they want to tell you how you're going to live.
Social manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
I guess
herd people into human settlements. I mean, if you look at Agenda 21, it says right in there, you know, they talk about human settlements.
Could you describe Agenda 20, United Nations Agenda 21 to us?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Could you just describe that to us so that everybody kind of understands what it is?
Agenda 21 is a plan that basically affects how everybody lives. I mean, it's an incredible plan to change the lifestyle of everybody. Now, and in one thing that I read, the way that they defined environment is everything that you touch and everything that touches you. So basically, it's your whole entire life. They want you to live in a planned community. They want to rewild huge sections of the United States. They consider people to be on the same level as a field mouse. You know, we're all just creatures on this earth, and there is no order of precedence, no food chain, as it were, except perhaps, you know, except for their position on the food chain. And I think it's the George Orwell thing. All of the animals are equal, except some are more equal than others.
Right, right.
Well, you were saying that the United States, actually, they're trying to wild. There's, I guess, they're going to do that worldwide. Am I correct? I mean, from what?
Yeah. Now, that part of it I haven't really gotten into too much, but I do know that there are areas, special places in the world that they've turned over to the UN.
World Heritage Area.
Yeah, World Heritage, that's right. That supposedly the UN is the conservator for. But as far as what's going on in our country, a lot of these, some of these environmental groups are really groups that were started by the wealthy elite in this country, and they use the cloak of environmentalism to basically get property, you know, steal your property. And what I've read is that some of the property, after it's been stolen, has actually been sold off for commercial purposes. And I can't give you any you know, hard examples of that, but that's what I've read, you know, from and heard from other people.
Actually, yeah. I saw on HGTV one time them showing a what do I want to call that? Conservation easement, I believe, that had been set aside, and they had it up for sale.
This is true. Mm-hmm. I know of cases of U.S. Forest Service land that's been auctioned off in California, Bureau of Land Management land near Las Vegas auctioned off near in Nevada, and recently Texas has state wildlife refuge land that has been auctioned off. And of course, when it's auctioned off, oftentimes there are kind of sweetheart deals with this or that lumber magnate or this or that billionaire who happens to have an interest in that area. So this is a way. Once you what you mentioned then is a way for under the auspices of environmental improvement of our society, large tracts of land can be set aside, and then the government can turn around and does and is in the process of turning around and auctioning those public lands off to the highest bidder or to the person that they intend to sell it to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody that they deem can use it to best use, whatever that means.
Or best profit or whatever. Okay, now this Agenda 21, what does this have to do potentially with the kind of human settlements that you were talking about?
Well, that's part of their plan is that is they want people to live in certain areas so that they can rewild the rest. And so, you know, if they, I don't know, you have to start thinking kind of crazy, I think, if you really start looking into this stuff. But they want to be able to plan your life so that you don't need to have a car, so that you can, you know, walk to your job, walk to your grocery store, you know, walk or take a bike or whatever, you know. But it's kind of I suppose they could do it. I don't know, but they really would have to completely change everything about life in America. You know, there is no more freedom of movement. You are assigned to an area, you know, one of these mega regions that they have defined as a population center, and that's where people will live.
Ultimately, that, you know, that really doesn't sound like such a horrible thing to certain people. I mean, to them, you know, there's many people out there that think, you know, having the pristine environment that is free of human beings who are what they consider destroying it. Although there are those that say that we do as good or better job than nature on some management of forests and that sort, but. The sad part about it is the ulterior motive behind those that are doing this social manipulation to create these zones or smart growth areas, and what they're doing is that they're doing it under false pretenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and if I lived in Manhattan, you know, for a while, and I loved it. because, you know, the subway was there. I didn't have to have a car. I could walk to the grocery store. I could get to work real easy. But most everybody that I know would hate it, absolutely hate it, because, you know, they grew up in the country in the rural areas and always have lived in the rural areas, and they would absolutely hate it. So, you know, the concept is not a bad concept in and of itself. It's the forced nature of it.
To go back to Agenda 21 for a second, Vicki, from what I understand, this came out of the United Nations, and one of the individuals who was instrumental in writing the policy was a Canadian billionaire named Maurice Strong. Mm-hmm. And he is the man who also started the first international environmental conference in 1972 in Stockholm, and then organized the Rio Earth Summit of 1992. He was also at various times Secretary General of the United Nations, and he has a completely different hat. He's also been the CEO of major water and power corporations all over North America. So he kind of rides both sides of the fence when it comes to resource profit and development and environmental monitoring of those resources. Anyway, so he writes this Agenda 21, and under Clinton in the 1990s, it is adopted by the United States, and it becomes very much part of the Rio Earth Summit treaties that are signed by most of the nations of the world. And it becomes, some of these ideas carry over to the Earth Charter, which Maurice Strong was also involved in writing. So I just wanted to kind of spread out that, or kind of flesh out that issue of Agenda 21, because I think most Americans are clueless that this exists.
Yeah, and it's available to be able to be read on the net, and it is a document that we should be reading, because this will kind of override our Constitution and Bill of Rights if we don't pay attention and put a wrench in the works.
Right, but in this country, though, it's being implemented under the heading of sustainable development.
Yes,
and that's one thing that people should be cautioned about, is that all of this UN agenda is about nothing if not the manipulation of language. And what they plan on is for you to read the term sustainable development and apply your own meaning to it. I mean, it sounds like something good. Yes, sustainable development, that's something we should all want, isn't it? But it doesn't. Sustainable development has a whole body of work behind it that includes Agenda 21, so it really isn't what anybody would be able to think of if they think of just the term sustainable development. So it's really all about misleading people as to what they're really talking about.
Yes,
it's a term that they can define any way that they want to for whatever situation they're in at the moment.
I'm glad you pointed that out. It has a 1984 Orwellian component to it, as does a lot of the language that we hear. Smart growth, sustainable development. Melody herself sent me some very interesting articles about the Agenda 21, smart growth, sustainable development, quoting a lady who wrote a book called Educating for the New World Order, similar to what you point out in your website, where they talk about how trained individuals trained in psychological techniques, come to communities, try to get these communities to reach consensus regarding quote-unquote sustainable development, and they have a whole series of techniques which enable them to take a group of people and move them to a preordained position which they've already decided on.
Mm-hmm.
This is a way. Yeah. This is basically a way to manipulate local populations, local cities, etc.
Yeah, it's group psychology, and the objective is to really deceive people. You know, they use the methods of group psychology to intimidate people and to make everybody think that they all arrived at this decision, but and the truth of it is that the decision was made in advance, and all this person did was guide you along the primrose path to thinking that that's what the group decided.
That's the Delphi technique. You want to get into a little bit on what the mayors, when you were telling me earlier today about?
Yeah, the in as part of President Clinton's, he stood up a council called the President's Council on Sustainable Development. And what their objective was to figure out how to implement Agenda 21 in the United States. And so that included all of the areas that Agenda 21 touches, which is just about everything. And let me get to a page here so that I can give you some dates. But one of the things that they ended up recommending was that the mayors of the cities, they had to get them engaged in sustainable development. And one of the ways that they did that was through the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And the Conference of Mayors, I guess, organized or participated in the an international conference of mayors, you know, for mayors of big cities all over the world.
And now, where was that held?
That was held in Paris.
And would that be a violation of the Logan Act?
I would think that it would be. I don't know how it wouldn't be, because they've had these mayors, you know, getting involved with the officials from foreign countries for quite a long time now, you know, and so I don't know why it wouldn't be, but let me see if I can find this date for you. Okay, the conference was it was sponsored by the Aspen Institute of France and the Aspen Institute of Berlin, and it was held in Lyon, France, and it was the Transatlantic Summit of Mayors. Okay, the summit was created by Felix Roy Hatton, and at the time he was the U.S. ambassador to France, and J. Thomas Cochran of the Conference of Mayors.
And when was that held again?
That was in 2000.
It's interesting, because I'd always thought that the Aspen Institute was an American institution, but apparently it's an international institution.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason why I happened to find this was because Boise's mayor, Brent Coles, happened to get involved in this, in this whole international conference, and it was all centered around sustainable development. And one of the, okay, the quote that you were interested in, Melody,
mm-hmm.
was that what these mayors were told at this conference is that, and this is a quote from New Orleans Mayor Mark Morio, "You can't be a mayor today without having your own foreign policy." Now,
wow.
when you think about that in the context of everything else that's going on in our country, which is the dismantling of our government, that's a pretty scary concept, you know?
Well, obviously, this is a very clever way to move the world towards this globalized New World Order, where national sovereignties are dissolved, and I suppose the corporate fascist system takes over. But before we get to that, which I guess is kind of the where all this leads, I was intrigued by Melody and yourself to get the idea that there might be a link between 911, the North American Union, and Agenda 21. And could you We have been talking about 911 with other guests. We've been talking about the North American Union with other guests. But putting these together is a intriguing concept. So I was just wondering if you could tell us how you think they might fit together.
Well, I wouldn't say Agenda 21 directly, but I would say 911 and the North American Union. And the way I found that connection was that I was doing some research on free trade, and I came across, you know, the FTAA, which is Free Trade of the Americas, and then I found relevant to that the Inter-American Democratic Charter. And it turns out that on September 11th, 2001, Colin Powell was in Lima, Peru, to sign the Inter-American Democratic Charter. And there is a think tank up in Canada that where a guy wrote a paper that called the Inter-American Democratic Charter the Magna Carta of the Americas.
That's a pretty significant name for it. So
yeah, it sure is.
So you're talking about a founding document.
Okay, well, there's a connection. Colin Powell signed the Inter-American Democratic Charter on September 11th, 2001, but that's not exactly what I was asking, thinking that was going to be where we were going.
Okay.
Is there more?
Well, just there... all of the research that I have subsequent, you know, that follows that, which is that all during the 1990s, Sandy Berger, he was the deputy for national security under Anthony Lake, and they set up a series of summits which were the beginning of the merger of the governments of our countries. And there's the summit in Miami, the summit, there's about four summits that they went through, and basically the goal of each summit is to set the direction for the agenda for next time, but it's actually the working groups, representatives from Canada, the United States, and Mexico, working together to merge our governments, harmonize the laws, coordinate the policies, you know, like the cross-border, you know, real ID, that sort of thing. So all during the early 90s, that's what Sandy Berger was working on, and he was working for Anthony Lake. And when John Deutsch left the CIA, Clinton had selected Anthony Lake to replace John Deutsch. But for some reason, he couldn't be confirmed because of something that he had done. Anyway, the Senate said no way. So that was when George Tenet was selected to be the director of the CIA. Now, here's an interesting thing about George Tenet. I don't think he had the background to be a CIA director. He, when he started in Washington, D.C., he was actually a lobbyist for the solar power industry.
Oh, boy.
And he went to work for John Hines, and Hines was very into environmental stuff. And then he was selected by Senator David Boren to be his chief of staff. And it was Boren who actually got Tenet into the National Security Council area of government. And it was from there that Tenet then became director of the CIA. And, you know, personally, I don't think he had any more of a background for the CIA than I did. What he did for Senator Boren was that he worked on CIA budgets. That was his initiation to the CIA.
Okay, well, getting back to the connection between September 11th and the North American Union, many of us who've done a lot of research on September 11th are convinced that it was an inside job, that it was carried out by our own military and intelligence agencies in order to give the Bush administration, quote-unquote, popular mandate to conquer the world, basically for the oil companies, but also to establish a transparent, or ostensibly, a 100 years of Pax Americana, and to establish a police state at home. You think that maybe the 911 was also a trigger that was supposed to bring in North American Union?
Yes, and I do for many reasons. If you research what George Tenet was doing at the CIA, what you find out is that all he was doing really is building a paper trail on who I call Osama bin Boogeyman. They had opportunities to get him. They didn't get him. And so I think all they were doing was setting up for a misdirection. And I really do think this was a planned agenda because the idea was to take our country apart and stand up the North American Union.
This is a way to bring America down. Of course, it was basically a terrorist tactic against the American people, wasn't it? It was a low-intensity way to terrorize, low-intensity conflict way to intimidate, i.e. terrorize, through the use of force, the American people.
Right, to set up a foreign enemy, and it gives them the excuse to set up a police state. And since you've studied the 9/11, you know that all of the cover stories were given to the American people on the morning of 9/11. Now, how is it that at 10 o'clock they're naming Osama bin Laden? You know, if it truly was a surprise, there wouldn't be anybody doing that or saying that.
Yeah, there's just literally thousands of reasons to come to that conclusion. The facts are so overwhelming. And yet, you know, in some of the people that I converse with once in a while, including some of my relatives, refer to this notion as my radical opinion. There seems to be a real determined effort on the part of many not to look at the basic information regarding 911. But I think that's changing slightly. But, okay, so 911 then becomes a pretext for radically changing the country, including moving us towards the North American Union. Are there any other direct contexts that you have or any direct connections that you have between these two?
Let me see.
I do know that the bin Laden family had had the contract on repairing the towers after the first bombing.
Oh, did they really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is something that a previous guest of ours told us, Alan Watt. I haven't seen that in print, but this is what he said, as well as the Bush family.
I've heard it.
Have you read that elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting thing.
Okay, so the North American Union, we've had some guests talk about that. In fact, our leaders have met for the last couple of years with the leaders of Mexico and Canada in order to, as you say, harmonize the laws and the regulations that would allow our countries to merge. What would be the downside of that from your point of view for us?
For us?
Yeah.
Loss of sovereignty. The whole framework of our country, our protections, our rights, our everything revolves around the Constitution. If they, with this merger, if they stand up a supranational governing structure, the Constitution is out the window, and your rights to free speech, everything that you consider your rights as an American, are down the toilet. That's the downside.
That's
I can't think of an upside, frankly.
Yeah. So what we'd do is this merger would probably, if it is successful, and I believe they want to pull this off within the next couple 3 years. Is that not true?
Yeah, they wanted it done by 2005, but they didn't make it. 2001, what happened on 9/11 kind of slowed them up, because people, of course, then started paying attention to what was happening on our borders and started insisting on tightening up the borders, and, you know, it kind of hasn't really worked out the way that I think they thought it would.
So the immigration policies that we have now in effect, where we have such a huge number of Mexicans in this country, this is all part of the same general plan to merge the countries, would you say?
Yes. You know, okay, here's an interesting way to start looking at that. If you look at what they've done with government departments, you know, when they started these working groups, they basically split our government departments into international sections and then the domestic sections. So basically they created divided loyalties within our own government. And one of the agencies where they did that is with the Border Patrol. They have the law enforcement Border Patrol, and then they have a group that's called BORSTAR. And BORSTAR's job is to rescue, search and rescue of people out in the desert. Well, their job is to save people, you know, while the Border Patrol's job is to catch people. But they're in the same department, the same directors directing their activities. So you have to know that one side or the other is going to be the favored side, while the other side is administratively cramped. Because you can't have dual missions in the same department.
So this really is a way of controlling the outcome of a situation where there would be controversy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I think about it is, do you remember that movie in the 1950s called Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
Yes.
Well, that's the way I see them doing with this BORSTAR unit. You know, the department that does the Customs and Border Patrol, they get so much money in their budget. Well, I think they have just been, you know, snatching bodies of border patrol that are law enforcement and getting rid of those guys and then hiring the BORSTAR. So, in effect, you have, you know, all this same number of people in the department, but the mission of the department has changed at the on-the-ground level. But as far as the Congress is concerned, they're looking at it as a department that has a mission to protect our borders.
And so that's why it looks like we don't have any much in the way of border patrolling.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's how I see it working. And you can do a search on for BORSTAR, that's BORSTAR, and read up on them, you know, because that unit is described and their purpose is described on the website.
Do you think that same tactic was at all used when they set up the European Union?
You know, it may very well have. I've only done enough reading on the European Union to know that we are following the same steps to go to, you know, from a sovereign nation to a union, that they did to Europe. You know, same game plan.
Yeah, just different time frames from what I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is one thing, though, on 9/11 that I do want to go back to. The Christian Science Monitor picked up a transmission from, I guess Jordan picked it up. Let me read you this quote. It says, sometime in late summer of 2001, the GID headquarters in Jordan intercepted a crucial Al-Qaeda communication. The message showed clearly that a major attack was planned inside the continental U.S. It said aircraft would be used, but neither hijacking nor apparently precise timing nor targets were mentioned. the code name of the operation in Arabic, and then they give the Arabic word, was the Big Wedding. Okay, and I, in the testimony, in the 911 testimony of both Sandy Berger and George Tenet, they talk about the plan. They were working on the plan, and that had to do with, you know, what was, you know, sending people over to Afghanistan, supposedly looking for Osama bin Laden and whatever. And the way I look at it is the plan was the Big Wedding, was the North American Union, which is what Colin Powell signed on September 11th, 2001.
That's an interesting connection, and possible, certainly. I guess we don't need to go into all the stuff about how Al-Qaeda was a fabrication of the CIA always and has always been an intelligence asset of the American military complex. That has been well documented. And those however many 18 other nations that warned us of 9/11, probably this was all part of the disinformation strategy that accompanied the operation, because it was an operation, a very, very, very sophisticated black operation carried out against the American people. Mm-hmm. But, okay.
So you might want to get into the federalism part. Well, wait a minute. I need to go ahead and do a break here, because this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. It's 45 degrees outside. And this is Truth Quest with Melody and Eric. And our guest tonight is Vicki Davis. And while I'm at it, I wanted to do a couple public service announcements. The Buena Vista CMC Jazz Project, directed by Gary S. Johnson, will present a concert in Salida Friday, December 7th at 7 p.m. at the United Methodist Church at 4th and D Street. Then in Buena Vista on Saturday the 8th at 7 p.m. at the Valley Fellowship Church, 608 South San Juan. The program will be will be a sumptuous buffet for jazz lovers, including works by Stan Kenton, Count Basie, the Beatles, and more contemporary sounds, as well as a touch of Christmas music. Everyone is welcome, and there's no admission charge. And you can learn aerobics, juggling, clowning, and other performance skills, and some scholarships are available to the next Salida Circus Camp to be held January 2nd through the 5th, 10 a.m. to noon at the Salida Library. For more information, call Jennifer at 719-207-4169 or visit salidacircus.com. And want to offer a scholarship for underprivileged kids? Please call Salida Circus at 207-4169. And Neighbor to Neighbor Volunteers, whose mission is to assist the elderly, disabled, and chronically ill, has expanded their service to include the Chaffee Shuttle. They assist with a long list of tasks that are not provided by other agencies. Their 10-passenger van will take you to the store, beauty shop, or any place you want to go for only $2 each way. For more information, call 530-0223. Again, get back to our guest, Vicki Davis. And we were getting into the federalism part.
The new federalism?
Yes, yes.
Okay, let me go there. Yeah, there's a book that Clinton and Gore wrote, or a report, actually. It's called the Blair House Papers. And I actually have that under the coup d'etat section. But it's about their plans for the new federalism, where they describe what it was that they were doing and why they were doing it. And it's all about basically contracting out the privatizing as much of government as they could. I don't know if you remember Clinton saying it, you know, but the era of big government is over, and let's see, but the challenges are not, is the way that he put it.
Okay.
Yeah. He went a long way towards tearing up the New Deal, rolling back welfare, as you say, privatizing the government, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was just picking up where George Herbert Walker Bush left off. I really do think they are partners in this endeavor. It's almost, I call them the Republican Mafia, but that's not really accurate because there are Democrats involved in it as well. But Clinton was as much a part of this as Herbert Walker Bush and George Bush, this latest edition of George Bush.
We've had guests on like Alfred Weber, who's been involved with an international war crimes tribunal in Malaysia, talking about the 911 crime inside job, who refers to a worldwide criminal racketeering group or network. We've had Webster Tarpley's written an excellent book, 911, Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA. He talks about how this operation was carried on by private networks. And, of course, for years we've been hearing about the shadow government or the secret government. Can you give us your sense of who are those guys? Who's doing this and how do they keep getting away with it?
Well, they get away with it because they're all involved in government, and if you look at the big major government contractors and members of Congress, they just rotate in and out of these companies, and you know the heads of departments, you know, the ones that are appointees. They just keep rotating back and forth between government and these large corporations. And basically, I think they're all on the same team, and they're, I think, against the American people. Basically, the American people are standing in the way of true world government. And I think we're about the only ones that are standing in the way. You know, once they crush us, then it's basically back to feudalism.
They can have their world fascist state. Is that right?
Yeah.
Would you call it the Fourth Reich?
Yeah, as a matter of fact. And I wrote a paper that was the title of it, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. That really had to do with Abu Ghraib and contracting out to, you know, contracting out military functions to contractors. And that was pretty early on, and I really can't say that at that point in time that I really had a good handle on 9/11. I'm not even sure that at the time I had researched 9/11. But I don't know, that I was just compelled to name it that.
Well,
and
we certainly.
So that's what I did, The Rise of the Fourth Reich.
You talk about Operation Paperclip, whereby the CIA and even the Vatican were involved in taking very, very top level SS officers from Germany just after World War II, as well as rocket scientists, as well as those doing all kinds of experimentation with biological weapons, etc., and mind control. These people were funneled into our defense apparatus, and including the Republican Party, that's been pretty well documented. So I don't think it's a gigantic stretch to use the word Fourth Reich at all,
mm-hmm.
considering the goals and the means to attain the goals seem quite similar, although many people have said America is the home of friendly fascism rather than the more overt, you know, in-your-face fascism we saw in Germany in World War II.
Well, you know, I think every time they try this, you know, they get better at it. You know, they've learned how to with television. Television is a perfect tool for manipulating people, because even with 9/11 and everything that's going on in our country, if you go talk to people on the street, if they're not really paying attention to the internet, they will be totally clueless as to, you know, what's going on in our country. And it's almost like if they don't see it on TV, it never happened. And since TB never shows them anything, you know, it's almost like a false reality is created by TB.
Virtual reality, really, isn't it?
Yeah. That's why I called my website Channeling Reality, because, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, what's real, what isn't, you know, what's going on here.
You know, I have a friend who I've known since high school, and we've had a chance to discuss these things, 911, et cetera. He's a Bush Republican, and we are good friends, and we do get along. But I remember one comment he said, well, you know, I listen to you, and what you say makes a lot of sense. And then I listened to Rush Limbaugh, and what he says makes a lot of sense. So it's kind of whoever I heard last.
No.
That was scary because he's so smart. You know, I don't know how one could say that. Personally, I don't understand how anybody could say what he just said there, but that's what he believes.
It sounds to me like he, you know, Rush says what he wants to hear. And
yeah. Perhaps that's the case. Yeah.
Well, I've noticed an interesting phenomenon. You know, when you're talking to somebody who is like a Rush Limbaugh fan, you know, totally in the matrix, if you should happen to say something that actually triggers their mind to work, it's almost like you see a moment of realization and then total shutdown. You know, like they bring the curtain down. You know, it's just too overwhelming to think about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm brazen enough to have a lot of very pointed bumper stickers on the back of my Toyota Tacoma, including 911 was an inside job and jail Bush and who would Jesus bomb and things like that. And lots of people come up and look at it and talk about it and take pictures of it. And I've seen some military types staring at it. And not quite knowing what to do with it, because most military types are very decent people, but they're just, I would say, brainwashed. And here is something that tries to rattle them out of that conceptual straitjacket, and it doesn't take you. You do see what you just said. You see them kind of struggling with it and then shut down.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
It's a most interesting phenomenon to see. And I have empathy for them, because I know at the very moment when I realized, you know, what was going on with our country, my whole body shook. I mean, I nearly came unglued. It was a moment of terror, because, you know, at the moment when you really, really grasp and you accept the reality of what's going on in our country, it's like it shakes the foundation of your world. And so I kind of have sympathy for people that do shut down. You know, some days I wish I had. You know, I wish I had been able to shut the curtain and not see all this stuff. But, of course, that's not me. But
well, and I think the metaphor of waking up is applicable here. I think you could make the case that even very, very intelligent and highly competent people in this country are very much asleep into this virtual reality until they somehow manage to wake up, as you have done through your research and as Melody and I are trying to do, and hopefully many others. And I guess my question to you, you make the point that it's the American people that stand between total victory for this group and some maintenance of our sovereignty and our civil liberties and our way of life. How are we doing in your estimation? Does it look good? Does it look bad? Are enough of us waking up fast enough? Or what do you think?
I'm worried. I think the jury is still out. I wish I had a better answer than that. But, you know, once after the year 2000, well, after 9/11, they really stepped up the pace of the agenda. And I work at this just about all day, every day, researching the different aspects of it, and they're coming at us from so many directions.
It's like a shotgun effect.
It's a full-court press, as we say in basketball.
Yeah. And it's really difficult, excuse me, to really grasp all of these different areas and try to keep up with what they're doing on each front. And so, you know, that happens to be, the ability to do that happens to be a talent that I have. But you know, for the average, both the talent and training that I have by way of my career. But, you know, for the majority of people out there, it would be impossible to do that.
Yeah, when you're trying to support yourself and raise a family and that sort of thing, it takes certain individuals to have to devote quite a bit of their time to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that's what you've done. When we were talking earlier today, you were getting a little bit into the background of Al Gore. And I kind of consider him a pretty interesting person because he kind of puts on different faces from what I'm seeing. You know, I mean, just even watching him when he ran for president in his speeches and things of that sort, and then to see him come back on a C-SPAN presentation he did later. I mean, it was like somebody else was in his skin or something. I mean, it was just a total different speech. And you want to get into a little bit with the research that you found on him?
Yeah. Well, the whole impetus for the summits, you know, leading to the North American Union, Free Trade of the Americas, Al Gore was heading up that whole thing. And it was Al Gore who was heading up the reinvention of government. And what I've kind of noticed, just as an observation, is that there always seems to be the front person who, you know, the person at the top of the department, head of the department or head of the corporation, who really is kind of a sock puppet, but the real power is like two or three levels down. That's, you know, that's where the real agenda is being executed or implemented.
And being that level, what level do you think that, where that's coming from?
I think it's a strategy.
Okay.
Especially with Congress, because if you notice, with congressional testimony, they almost always only have the heads of the appointees of a department testify. They very rarely go to deputy secretaries and undersecretaries. And so that maintains plausible deniability for everything that they're doing.
Even when they cornered somebody like Condoleezza Rice, who could just, flat lie as far as I was concerned, but
well, yeah, and unless you were there, it's hard to know what really went on there, or, you know, what was in that report. We know what was said in the hearing, but, you know, were we, I don't know if the text of it was ever released, and even if it was, they would have left out the parts that they consider to be secret. So that's the hard part, you know, with filtering through everything that is said and done, because you don't know, did she really ignore it, or is she being set up? I have a hard time believing that somebody would sit in a hearing, congressional hearing, and just flat out lie to Congress. Because especially on something that it's going to be easy to catch them on.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me like back in the day of Oliver North, there was, when he was doing his testifying, I don't know how you could not say what he was doing. I mean, by the way that, you know, I don't know. I have a hard time thinking that he wasn't openly lying.
He admitted it.
Well, yeah. I think, you know, they were. But he did ultimately admit what it was that they were doing, and he did it defiantly so. And what happened to him? Nothing. You know, but if they were seriously investigating things, I mean, if, you know, if this was a serious investigation trying to figure out what would happen or what happened on 9/11, I would have a hard, you know, maybe this is just my own, you know, character coming out or something, but I have a hard time lying to people. You know, you can see it on my face, and so I have a hard time thinking of other people being able to do it and maintain a poker face, you know, and not give themselves away.
What do you consider your most the work that you've done? What are you most proud of?
In terms of this research,
mm-hmm.
I think that the research that I've done on 9/11 has been pretty good because it's been in areas not covered by most 9/11 truthers.
Okay.
And one of the things that I wrote, which actually I didn't intend to have published, I just put together an email and emailed it out, but it ended up on the front page of Rents.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was research that I found on the command and control centers, and I, you know, wrote up a whole page on that, and that was a pretty good find.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I'll have to find it because it's kind of complicated, and it mm-hmm. has to do with the new American way of war. Now, if you go, do you know who Thomas Barnett is?
I recognize the name, but I'm not quite sure where I've heard it.
Yeah, well, Thomas Barnett wrote a book called The Pentagon's New Map. And actually, I guess it would be the Thomas Barnett stuff that I would have to say that I'm proud of, because what Thomas Barnett did is that he gave a present. He was a professor at Military College in Rhode Island. And he was working for Admiral Art Sabrowski. And Art Sabrowski is the guy that that they call the father of net-centric warfare. And basically, they're the ones that were involved in transformation of the military to a 21st century military force. And basically what that means is that they decided that the old model of military, you know, that was for big war, you know, like World War II, World War I, was never, ever going to happen again. And so they were redesigning the military for 21st century war. And Art Sabrowski wrote this paper on the new ways of war, and basically it calls for effects-based operations, which is what? It's terrorism. Small forces, small groups of special forces teams networked together doing effects-based operations. Well, as you're reading this stuff, you realize, well, that's the definition of Al-Qaeda, isn't it? You know, small teams engaged in effects-based operations.
And this is an article that you wrote, or Art Sabrowski?
No, Art Sabrowski did, and it's The New American Way of War.
And this is on your website?
Yeah, I have a link to it on my website.
Okay.
So a lot of your research is on your website with the diagrams and charts and things of that sort.
Well, mostly just what I write.
Oh, okay.
And includes links to things. I don't get enough into the detail of things to do charts for the most part.
No, I don't mean your own charts, but other people's charts.
Oh, yeah, other people's.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Vicki, in terms of your kind of overarching themes here, coup d'etat, new federalism, somewhere in there Congress gets taken out, doesn't it? Congress gets neutralized, and the balance of power, the checks and balances that once made this country viable have been lost, and we've moved into essentially a de facto dictatorship where a president has done over 800 signing statements saying he doesn't have to execute this or that congressional law, and he has done I don't know how many hundreds of executive orders, which essentially in which he makes the laws, which of course is the function of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So has this been a long-term plan, you think, to take Congress out of the picture?
I really can't say how long obviously, you know, when they did the new federalism, the outsourcing of government, I'll tell you for sure that the contracting companies, the contracting corporations, knew precisely what they were doing.
So are the think tanks kind of doing the job for the Congress on writing laws?
I think the working groups are.
Well, when I'm saying working, think tanks is what I'm referring to as working groups, I believe.
No, I think there's a distinction.
Oh, is there?
They're a different animal, right. Yeah. The think tanks like Heritage and Cato, and they write policy papers. But I think it's actually the working groups that include government workers from both from Mexico and Canada and the private sector. I think they're the ones that are actually writing or coming up with the concepts for the legislation. And I never really understood that or thought that before this last immigration bill when LaRaza was involved in it. LaRaza was involved in putting together that legislation. And the only way that I could figure that that could happen was if the working groups themselves that are doing the merger of our government operations, if they were involved in putting together the legislation for how they want it to work.
Earlier when we talked today a little bit about the tie-in with how a lot of Soviet-type systems are being implemented into our lifestyle, do you want to get into that a little bit?
Well, I can't really talk about that as much. I do have a Russian connection on my website.
Okay.
But back in 1985 or something, well, first of all, let me say that George Shultz, he was Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
His family were communists. And, you know, I suppose some people might say, well, that's not fair to say that he was a communist just because he came from a family of communists. But I believe he probably was a communist because he was friends with Gorbachev, and he signed an agreement with the Soviets to harmonize our education system with the Soviet system. And it was after that agreement was signed that Reagan got us out of UNESCO, but that never stopped them from implementing the UN, the UNESCO agenda in our schools anyway. It's another case of, you know, they do something for appearance's sake, but behind the scenes they're doing what they want to do anyway.
Well, I can add a little bit to that, and that is that Schultz was also head of Bechtel, one of the biggest corporations of San Francisco, and of course they've profited, and they are profiting mightily from the war in Iraq. But he's also, I think, what, Secretary of State under Reagan? But yeah, there's so much research now by various people like Anthony C. Sutton and many, many others that show that communism was funded and created as a kind of a controlled opposition for the super-rich capitalists, so that always the Soviet Union was bankrolled, and the five-year plans were given by American corporations. And I mean, there's a vast literature about this, which I have tapped into. So communism has always been the intended super enemy, but created by the people that are the super capitalists. So communism, capitalism, two forms of potentially totalitarian government, as well as fascism, all controlled by the same financial elite at the same time. This is, I think, one of the greatest tricks, frauds of all time, and most Americans are clueless about this fact, or these facts.
Well, there's a really interesting video on YouTube that's a presentation by a man named George Reisman. That's R-E-I-S-M-A-N. And he was at the von Mises Institute. And what he was doing was giving a presentation on the differences between the Russian communism or socialism and the Nazi version of socialism. And really the only difference was that in Russia, it was the government that was openly in control of the large, what you would call corporations, you know, that do the production. Only they really weren't corporations because they were part of the government. In the German system, they still had a socialist system, but the corporations like IG Farben and Krupp and, you know, the others, they really were part of the government, but they maintained the facade of being private corporations. And so that's why people thought that Nazi Germany really wasn't socialist, that there was a difference between, you know, the Russian and the German edition. But in fact, really the only difference was superficial.
Yeah, and I think the great irony is that both systems are ultimately owned and controlled by a relatively small number of banking families, international banking families. And I guess this gets into my next question. We're now – your first segment in your on the Silent War indicates or I think gives lots of documentation for the fact that there is a group that is at war with the American people, that are doing terrorism and low-intensity conflict techniques on the American people. They're all the more effective because most Americans don't even know that this war is occurring. But, of course, the maxim of know your enemy is essential. So who is our enemy? Who are those guys? Is it just the CEOs? Is it just the heads of government? Is a guy named Alan Watt from Canada, who was one of our guests, said he guessed that there were only about 3,000 in the international ruling elite of the world that is driving this system towards, as you say, new feudalism. Do you have any insight?
I think he's right. But as far as our enemies, I mean, our enemies could be anybody, could be your next-door neighbor. That's the thing, you don't know. Anybody who is helping implement the agenda, and these networks of groups of people who are doing things, we don't know who they are, but they have to be considered the enemy because they're the ones that are carrying it out. You know, could be the people that are setting the big forest fires, which I think are being used to burn people out of the rural areas. But in terms of just, you know, who's driving the agenda, I think it has to be those 3,000 people in the world. They want to ensure their control. See, what the Internet did what the internet is doing is that it's leveling the playing field in terms of the availability of knowledge right now, at least for this brief period of time, and for who knows how long. But I think that scares the elite, you know, because the more people know,
the more they're exposed.
Yeah, the more they know, the less likely it is that they're going to be able to manipulate them.
Yeah, information is crucial. Information is the key, I think, to coming out of this matrix. Indeed, Alan Watt has a website, Cutting Through the Matrix. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but he calls it the Matrix, which has been very, very carefully constructed to keep us into this virtual false reality system that you're also trying to break through.
Vicki, what in your background do you think gives you a little bit of heads up to in some of that internet information that maybe the rest of us might not pick up on as easily?
Well, my training as a systems analyst, first of all, it's not only a skill, but it's a talent. And, I hate to say I have a talent, but it is a talent, and it's the only one I have. there's nothing else in life that I do that I have a talent, but this is a talent that I have, which is to be able to find the system in the chaos, because behind every conspiracy or every agenda, there is a plan, and there are steps that people take to accomplish the plan. And if you can tap into one piece of it, it can lead you to all the rest of it. Because it's kind of like getting inside their mind and following their trail. You know, if you can tap into that, I don't know.
That yes, you know, some of the
nuts,
well,
doesn't it?
Well, but yeah, I've found that in my own work that I do, that it's some obscure thing you might look up on the internet and find that it ties into what you're looking for, and it wouldn't have been an avenue that you would have ever considered. But the internet, with the search engines and things of that sort, makes it a phenomenal thing, so that you can find these tie-ins with these obscure facts or words or people.
Right, and it's not just picking up words, but it's being able to see the conceptual thinking behind the words. Because if you can grasp the conceptual thinking behind the words, then it can send you searching in a totally different direction than you would have had you just been searching for an exact word or term or something like that. And so I can't tell you how I do that. I just, I just do it.
It's your talent.
and it's not a unique talent. There are other people that, like the other researchers that I work with, some of these people are just so brilliant. It's,
Yeah, it would seem to me that any person involved in this kind of research needs a very good memory to remember all the little factoids that need to be explained in a larger pattern. But is there a scientific method to this? Is it more? Would it be more kind of gestalt intuitive, or do you think that there is a kind of an orderly process that is being used? I mean, I'm asking because I don't know. I'm just curious.
Well, it's hard for me to say. I mean, early on in my training as a systems analyst, I was trained in the Jordan method of analysis. And basically what the Jordan method was to identify the major processes. You know, for example, like if one computer system that I worked on was for the, I did a requirements analysis for the State of Alaska Marine Highway Ferry System. Well, you know, when you're doing a system that big, you basically have identifiable main segments. And the Jordan method was a way to organize information in such a way that you create indices basically in your own mind, you know, that are a hierarchy of concepts. So that if you were going to do a diagram of it, you would put your main process in a bubble, and that bubble breaks down into more detail. But it's the ability to be able to focus in on the high level concepts and not get lost in the detail.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if that made any sense to you.
No, that helps. Yeah, I do see you're using a kind of a certain kind of a structured process, and then you probably depart from that as you need, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, which is why, you know, if you ask me a specific date, I'll have to look it up, because I don't retain detail like that. I retain concepts and you know, phrases,
how things operate,
things like that. But for the most part, I really don't remember dates.
When with your other researchers in the research that you're doing, do you find that you guys are coming to some of the same conclusions?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, we do. Like for example, I was working on something with the superhighway with another researcher, and she had been trying to trace back to the beginning of the usage of the term superhighway. And the reason she was doing that was because that was during that propaganda campaign, you know, when Dick Cheney said there is no such thing as superhighway, and then there was an article in the Nation and an article on Alternet, and you know, it was kind of like a concerted campaign to try and discredit anybody who said that there is a NAFTA superhighway. So she was researching it, and we and another researcher came in on it, and what we started seeing was the connection between the superhighway, the corridor, and total information awareness. Which, do you know what total information awareness is?
No, go ahead and tell us.
Well, it's a computer system that basically the idea is to have every bit of information about you. You know, from your medical records to your school records to your credit history to what books you check out at the library. I mean, total information awareness. Well, what we found out in this research is that the corridor is not only just a straight corridor, it's not just a straight roadway, it's a smart corridor. They're planning on it being the world's first totally automated, fully smart highway. And that means GPS tracking, it means remote sensors on the highway to be able to identify, you know, people that are in the cars, and to be able to bill you by the mile, you know, for your travel on this roadway. I mean, just totally automated highway. Well, turns out that all of this surveillance software that they're and systems that they're building for the international corridor is total domain awareness, which is a part of total information awareness, right? You can't have total information awareness without total domain awareness.
And that meaning?
Means total awareness of the surroundings, the physical surroundings.
Okay, you've lost me a little bit on that. Okay, so the total so that's knowing everything about us, and then you're saying that the domain has to do with the surroundings that is around us. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay, your car, there is a lot of technology. If you're driving a new car, any car that's older than about 1989, I think, it has computers in it. It has technology in it. And even more so now, if you have a new car, it has computer systems in it that can be controlled remotely. But it also has probably RFID technology in there that can transmit. So if you have a sensor on the side of the road and you're driving your car by, it can pick up the RFID, you know, vehicle number of your car, and a record will be created that you drove by this point at precisely this time of the day. Now, if you have once they get the real ID and the real ID has an RFID chip on it, it may even be able to read the RFID cards, so they would know not only that your car passed by this point at this particular time, but that you and your husband were both in the car.
So
because it picked up the RFID from your driver's licenses.
Okay, now, earlier we were talking a little bit about the GIS system and the IBC and these different... does this tie into this too?
Well, the GIS systems, that's mapping. That's okay. Mapping software, as far as I know.
Okay, all right.
And what they can do is they can take satellite images of the United States, and basically I think they're using that satellite imaging to be able to design, like the international corridors and stuff. They're using it for information to be able to design big structures.
Could you, Vicki, several questions come to mind, but you were talking about these NAFTA superhighways or corridors, which would also be smart corridors. Could you give us your impression of what the larger context of these, the planned contexts of these corridors would be in the minds of these apparently megalomaniacal individuals who want this kind of total control?
Well, they would be able to control mobility to basically be able to, if they choose, to be able to keep you within a confined area. And if you were to leave that area, they would know because of the RFID chip. Basically, they would be able to control all of your movements because they could watch, and if... Have you seen those ankle bracelets, have you read about those ankle bracelets they have for people that are on probation?
Yeah.
Right.
No.
Well, the way they work, those things work, is that as long as the person stays within a certain distance of the sensor, they're okay. If they go even, 1 foot too far away from the sensor then dials up the probation officer and says, prisoner XXX has just left his controlled area. And with these sensor systems, the surveillance systems that they're building on the highways, they'll be able to do a very similar kind of thing. Now, all this kind of stuff, the ultimate uses for this kind of stuff are probably, 50 years out or so. But the potential is there, and I do believe that that's what they'll be using them for.
We had one guest, and maybe Melody can help me remember who it was, who talked about how the technology is very close now to establishing these kind of chips in a person's brain that could actually more or less take over that individual and turn it into a cyborg type of robot. So you could essentially have an entire race of slaves who would then work for the whatever ruling elite gets to live better, and that these cyborg slaves could be programmed in such a way that, you know, they could even perhaps enjoy what they're doing, much like Brave New World. So would you see this NAFTA super corridor be a kind of a total control grid in this kind of a world?
Yes, absolutely.
You've run across these ideas?
Well, I don't really run across them, but, you know, whenever I hear about technology, because I was a systems designer, I designed computer systems. So when I hear about the technology, I can think of what the potential is for that, for the use of that technology. And so, you know, a lot of it, I don't have to read about it because I just know that they'll be able to do it.
Okay. I talking to Melody, she said you were very aware of the promise computer technology and perhaps also the PTEC computer technology and how it might have been used in the 911 operation.
That's purely speculation, but I do think that the command and control centers are all a part of that. I don't know if they used this promise software at all, you know, to be able to gain access. But I do know that, you know, for these command and control centers that they have planned, what they are doing is that because of terrorism, you know, as the coordinated way to handle terrorism, they are designing these command and control centers, and the software in those centers tap into the computers of other businesses. And I know that one business that they can tap into is the broadcast system. And they've always been able to do that because of national defense, right?
Mm.
I mean, about once a month or so, you get that blank screen that says, this is a test of the civil defense system, blah, blah, blah. If this had been an emergency, you would have been instructed to tune into some radio station. Well, the technology is so far beyond that. The image of the technology that they get with that message, but they basically can take over the whole broadcast grid if they want to. You know, if there really was a national emergency, they could just, you know, grab the whole broadcast network away from the private broadcasters and the radio broadcasters, and they could, you know, then do their civil defense messages.
Well, just to kind of follow up on that idea, there have been many, many, many 911, international 911 investigation conferences around the world since 911, and some of the experts who have presented at these conferences are really, truly impressive, and one of them is a lady named Indira Singh, who was talking about the connection between terrorism, the drug economy, and 911, and PTEC computer technology. And she worked with, I think, Morgan Bank in New York City, and found herself also working with intelligence agencies, and she was propelled into a very high echelon classified situations by virtue, I guess, of being very, very smart systems analyst like yourself. And I've seen some of her talks on DVD, etc. and she knows she has these kinds of connections, and she has she can testify to this. So.
Yeah, I've encountered Indira Singh.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And yeah, I know her story.
Yeah. Okay.
How shall I say this? I'm not. I'm not altogether. I'm not sure about Indira Singh. Let me just put it that way.
Okay. Well, see, another guest of ours said that a lot of the 911 truth movement is a counterintelligence operation.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we face when we try to understand what happened in 911 is a lot of fabricated evidence on the one hand, and on the other hand, people who come forward to testify who may be trying to set people off on the wrong trail. Now,
yeah.
Would you suggest that she might be one of these?
Well, it's hard to say. It's really, really hard to know. You know, who are the people that are stooges, and who are the people who are actually players in the game?
I agree.
And so, you know, I hesitate to, you know, point the finger at anybody and say that they are either one or the other, because I really don't have a way of knowing unless they happen to make it really obvious. But the problem that I have with Indira is that she came to view by way of Michael Rupert, right? His website,
mm-hmm.
From the wilderness. Well, there was a background information, a background article written on Indira that was written by a guy named Michael Caine. And there were things in that in the background that he wrote that were absolutely impossible, like that she set up the first IT department for First Boston in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's not that old for her to have done that. And so that was a fabrication. And another thing was that she said she was an EMT and a systems analyst. Well, you know, being in the computer business, you know, a systems designer, systems analyst, that's a very intense business. And before 2000, there was never a time when there wasn't really work available. So I don't believe that a person would have had time to have a dual career like that. Because being an EMT is also intense. Takes a lot of education, takes a lot of experience. And so I don't know how you could have a dual career like that. So I'm suspicious of that.
Well, I appreciate your comments on that, because the more I go in this whole endeavor of trying to understand what happened on 9/11, the more I realize there is lots and lots of counterintelligence going on, and you have to become more and more sophisticated in your ability to kind of try to weigh the testimony of each and every individual mm-hmm. with these kinds of background checks. So,
yeah. So now, as far as what she was saying about PTEC, I know that PTEC software is a real problem. It's a serious problem. Because I heard even Senator John Warner on the floor in a committee meeting, I think, or a hearing, he mentioned PTEC software. So, and I've done research on the Promise software, which was the precursor for it. And so I do believe the whole, you know, Promise PTEC part of the story, and I wouldn't doubt at all that they that they were trying to get it implemented into JP Morgan. And the way that she described it, you know, as being a control system that could shut down the systems of JP Morgan, well, you know, it The problem I had with her story when she was telling that, you know, was that this these Arabs were trying to sell the PTEC software, a company called BMI or something. The way she told that story, it would be the same thing as a bank robber walking into a bank saying, let me show you how I can crack your safe. Well, you know, computer consultants generally are very smart people, and they would be too smart to walk into a bank and say, let me show you how I can get into your computer system.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, so if they did that, if this company did in fact do that, then I would have to say, well, they're not really real computer consultants. They're just front people.
Vicki, I'm going to have to, you know, come to a conclusion here on this evening, and I really do appreciate you sharing with us, you know, some of your experience on your research. And is there anything you want to quickly say as a summation before we call it a night?
Just go to my website and read, and I hope that everybody that's listening. Do the research. You know, don't take anything that anybody says as an absolute. Take it and use it as a guide to where to begin for your own research. Verify everything.
Well, again, I want to thank you, and it's 11 o'clock now, and it's KH.